This is WJBC This Week.
The administration is trying to unilaterally withdraw from the war on terror.
The entire Parks and Rec department is wants.
Competition and growth is the long-run way to get rising wages, not force.
It was obviously a full attack on the middle class and working women and men.
In order to better share, have a shared identity, we decided to go with another name identity for the school.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we recap the top news stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, Senator Dick Durbin pushes to keep the children of illegal immigrants from being deported. A local veteran who served as a sniper in the Vietnam War shares his thoughts on the box office hit American Sniper. A domestic violence abuse counselor discusses the NFL's attempt to promote abuse awareness, including the creation of an ad that'll run during the Super Bowl. A union leader reacts to Governor Bruce Rauner's idea to create right-to-work zones in Illinois. And a state lawmaker tries to prevent the sale of powdered alcohol. That and more coming up this WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Senator Dick Durbin took time to speak on the Senate floor each day this past week to try to keep protections in place for the children of immigrants who come into the U.S. illegally. A bill was passed in the House to end the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals program, which could mean deportation for those currently under its protection. Durbin talked about that and his unlikely alliance with the Republican Congressman Aaron Schock on the so-called Marketplace Fairness Act, as Durbin talked to WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
I think humanizing it is, I guess, a helpful way to allow everyone to understand what this really means.
If you had someone speeding down I-55, pulled over by a state trooper, and said, "You're speeding, we're going to give you a ticket," and then they look in the back seat and say, "Wait a minute, there's a five-year-old kid back there, we're going to give him a ticket for speeding too." And you say to yourself, "That's not right. That kid was sitting in the back seat, he wasn't driving." This is what happened to these young people. They were brought to America by their parents. They didn't make that decision, but they grew up here. They went to our schools. They got up every morning, pledged allegiance to the flag, sang the national anthem, considered themselves Americans, and then realized by the time they got to the age of reason, heck, we don't have the papers. We're not legal here. We're undocumented. So the question is, what do we do with them? There are some who say, get rid of them. You know, we don't want them, deport them. Let's say their parents did the wrong thing. They should pay a price. I don't think that's right. If these are good young people who are finishing high school, going on to college, or going on to serve in our military, give them a chance to become part of America's future. So I've been at this for 14 years. That's how long ago I introduced the DREAM Act. And now I get up on the floor of the Senate, and I tell stories every day of these young people and what they've done with their lives, and it's nothing short of amazing. The president has said they're not going to be deported. They can have a chance in the United States, and 600,000 have registered for that opportunity. These are good people, good young people, and I think they deserve the chance. There's a real fight on. The House Republicans said, we want to deport them all, get rid of them. And when you hear these stories, you start to ask yourselves, why would we give up on young people with such potential to be a big part of America's future?
Well, you've been on the floor every day sharing the stories here. Have you heard from anyone? Have you swayed anyone?
Well, you know, I've been around the Senate for a while, and I kind of sense what's going on in the chamber. When I pop up those pictures on the easels of these young people and tell their stories, everybody stops talking, and they look up, and they look at the photos, and they realize, you know, these are real people, real lives. And when you tell these stories, they shake their heads and say, why would you want to deport Juan Rios, who now has a degree in aeronautical engineering, wanted to enlist in the Air Force? He never got a penny of help from the government to go through college. Now he just wants to go to the Air Force if he can, serve our country. Why would you want to deport that young man? And that's what it's all about. You've got to humanize it. You've got to tell the real-life stories of who these people are.
Well, and you wonder what will happen. You told a story of a woman named Ola Caso who, you know, was 5 years old when her parents came over from Albania. And now she's gone through medical school. She wants to be an oncologist. And, you know, she spent a lot of money going, her parents spent a lot of money putting her through medical school, and we know we could use doctors in this country.
Oh, you bet.
And she's going to be deported.
Loyola Medical School up in Chicago, they decided when the president passed what's called DACA, that says these young people will not be deported. They'll be able to stay 2 years at a time. Loyola Medical School said, we're going to have a competition. We're going to have 10 slots that are open for medical school, and it's for these dreamers to apply to. Well, you can imagine what they got. They had some of the best and brightest young kids around America who never had a chance to go to medical school. Now they do. And they had to come under the condition that if they finish medical school at Loyola, they're going to go to underserved areas in Illinois and across America. They're going to go to rural communities that don't have doctors. They're going to go to inner city health clinics, and they're prepared to do it. They're ready to step up and do it. Are we going to be a better nation if those 10 doctors are serving downstate communities that are desperate in their hospitals, as you say, for an oncologist or somebody who's going to be there to serve our people? Of course we're better. Why would we want to make them leave some spiteful act because they were brought here as children? I don't think that's the right approach.
All right. And more bipartisan agreement here. I was shocked, no pun intended, when I saw that you and Congressman Aaron Schock are in agreement on something.
How
because,
about that for an outcome?
I'll take, because, you know, we'll have you on and we'll have him on and we'll quote you to him and vice versa. And
That's right.
But here we go with the Marketplace Fairness Act, and this is to level that playing field for small businesses, taxing, well, you tell the story here. Taxing internet purchases.
Everybody knows Chris Coos, Mayor of Normal. And the mayor has a shop, I forgot.
The test cycle shop. Often running and the test cycle.
That's right. And he sells running shoes and bicycles. And he has people that come in there and they try on shoes and they look at the bicycles and they write down little numbers and they leave. He doesn't see them again. What they do is go on the internet. They buy what Chris is selling and many other people are selling in shops all around Bloomington Normal, and they buy it on the internet and they don't pay sales tax. And there's Chris sitting there saying, here I am under law collecting sales tax so that we can have traffic lights in Normal and police protection and fire protection and repair the streets. And meanwhile, I'm losing out to some internet retailer who left the house and they didn't call it. And I hope that changes. I hope we move forward on this. Incidentally, Amazon, the largest retailer, supports us. And they just announced this week they're going to start routinely collecting sales taxes and sending them back to the states and localities. So it's coming. It's going to change. If the largest internet retailers move in that direction, ultimately everyone will.
Have you heard from opponents of this? And if so, what are they saying?
Have I heard from, I'm sorry. You
opponents, you know, people who are against this, businesses against this.
Well, you know, the only major business against it is eBay, and I can't quite tell you why. It seems to me that if we apply it to everyone, eBay is not going to be disadvantaged. And they're the only major opponents, and that's about it. Some people are worried and spooked by the notion that we're using the tax word, but this isn't a new tax. It's an existing tax, and it's just collecting it for the benefit of our state, for the benefit of communities, and particularly for the benefits of those bricks-and-mortar businesses that really support our communities.
Now it was Senator Dick Durbin with Scott and Colleen. The top box office hit in recent weeks is American Sniper, the biographical war drama which portrays a Navy SEAL proclaimed as the most lethal sniper in American military history. WJBC's Red Pitcher talked this week to a retired Marine who served as a sniper during the Vietnam War, Billy Reed of Bloomington, to get his thoughts on the film.
Did you come away, Billy, thinking it was a very accurate portrayal of the job that a sniper has?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, anybody that's listening, I'm not Chris Kyle. I'm not a Navy SEAL. I'm just a guy from Schooners.
You're just a walrus. You're not a SEAL. You're a penguin.
When I did what I did, it was 46, 47 years ago. It was a different time. There was different technology, different terrain, different objectives. I told Ray this morning, I said, I'm still thinking about the movie. We were both blown away with it. And I finally kind of decided I figured it out. Everything was totally different than what I knew. Yet, for some reason, it was totally the same. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of the way I took took it.
When you went through sniper training, you said it was 6 weeks. Is, you know, a bulk of it obviously had to be shooting.
It
was a different weapon than what we had issued in Vietnam, which was the M16.
Right. It was a Remington 700 with a Redfield scope, and at the time it was considered to be, you know, top-of-the-line weapon. From what these guys use now, it's I have to tell a quick story here about the sniper school, and I think it was 4 or 6 weeks. It's irrelevant. But I had the opportunity 2 years ago to go to Camp Pendleton to go to a graduation of sniper school in 2012. And I took I was very fortunate. I got to take my wife, and my daughter went with me. But the story is that these guys, what they use now, just unbelievable. I mean, we were using flintlocks compared to what these guys are using today. I mean, and it was kind of funny because I think there was 14 Marine graduates. Two SEALs were with them, and there was a couple foreign guys from Slovenia that they had brought in to train. But the stuff that they use now is just unbelievably complex, and I mean, it's just nowhere close to what we had. But.
Well, the word even implies sniper. You know, if you snipe at somebody, that's a negativity.
Yeah.
But
that's why I wasn't really sure I wanted to come up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but and I think in World War II, I don't know how many, because we were the attacking force in all the instances, whether it was in the Pacific or in the European theater. German snipers, Japanese snipers. You didn't hear a lot about American snipers.
No, but they were there. You know, I kind of, not very many people really know I said that, but a few people that do, the first thing they'd always get, they watch too many Guadalcanal Diaries. And always said, were you in a tree? And I go, no, I wasn't in a tree.
In a tree.
You know, all that stuff. But that's the ones you always remember, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, and when you – it was a lonely job, though. I mean, we'll just touch on it very briefly. It is not a job where you have a lot of camaraderie. If you're in a grunt unit, there's a tremendous amount of camaraderie between the guys in that particular unit. And in any unit, you're around. It's more social. Whereas in your particular job, it wasn't exactly social.
No, but you know, I will tell you, I tell everybody that knows me that I being a sniper probably is the reason that I'm here. I was in a grunt. I was in a hotel company. I was in a grunt company in the 5th Marines for 2 months, and let me tell you, being a sniper was a lot better.
Yeah.
It really was. I mean, it was just you and your partner, and we were always attached to a company. But we had a small, I don't know how many guys we had in our unit, maybe 30, and working in pairs and stuff. But to this day, some of those guys are my best friends, and I was with, for the most part, some really, 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 really good Marines and some good guys. And to this day, we still get... We never got together for 30 years, and then we had a reunion, and now we get together every 2 years, and we're, you know, three or four or five of us are very close still. My daughter got married last May in Florida, and one of my buddies, who's an ordained minister now, and he would have been the last person on the world that you thought would be a minister, married her, and all my buddies were there, and it was fantastic, and we're close, and I was really, really fortunate. I have no complaints. I was with some really good people.
What do you attribute the popularity of this movie? American Sniper, we're talking about, and Billy Reed was a Marine grunt and sniper in the Vietnam War and saw the movie last week, can relate to us. None and all of the movie.
Well,
as
I
you
think,
said, it's paradoxical for you.
I think all Americans kind of like quote unquote heroes. I mean, I think he's kind of, you know, he led the, you know, number of, I hate the word, use the word sometimes, but he had more kills than anybody. And then, of course, his tragic ending. At the end, I like to think the same way that Chris Kyle said, I'm not Chris Kyle, but you know, he feels that he saved lives. He didn't, you know, he saved American lives. He saved Marine lives. He saved lives. And so when people say that he was this or that, it kind of hacks me off because he saved lives, our lives.
Yep.
You know, when wars go on, you know, you don't want to think about it, but it's you or them, and he saved lives, and he saved a lot of lives, and then I think touched a lot of people. I mean, and of course, the tragic ending was not good, but I think people like those stories.
That was ex-Marine sniper Billy Reed with our Red Pitcher. Illinois could join a growing list of states that's banning powdered alcohol or palcohol. This includes drinks like freeze-dried vodka, rum, and cocktails. State Senator Ira Silverstein, a Chicago Democrat, wants to keep those products from ever reaching store shelves in Illinois, though its makers say buyers will just go to the black market if they have to. Silverstein talked to WJBC's Terry James this week.
Is this something that you thought would ever come about?
No, I haven't. This has been banned by the FDA. A lot of states now. Can I start over again?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
We'll edit that.
Okay. No, I didn't think I'd be able to introduce.
Go ahead. No, we'll be. It's on tape, so we'll edit.
Okay. Tell me one.
Go ahead.
No, I didn't think I'd be introducing a bill like this. The FDA recently reversed itself on a bill on an item that was similar to powdered alcohol. And other states are following the lead to ban this type of substance. It's a very dangerous substance that people can put in alcohol drinks that dissolves into alcohol. That dissolves into alcohol and can be eaten and be snorted without mixing. So I think it's pretty dangerous, especially for young people too. So we're trying to be preventive here.
Yeah. Do we know if this has any sort of taste to it that people would be able to tell if the powdered alcohol was, for instance, sprinkled on their fettuccine Alfredo instead of Parmesan? And I'm joking a little bit there, but that's something that could happen.
No, I don't think it's a joke. I think it's serious. You know, I don't know if it has a taste, but it's something that other states have been looking at. In fact, on the federal level, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York has introduced a ban on a federal level. So, you know, it's unfortunately we're always trying to keep ahead of the curve here in the Illinois legislature. And it is a powder or a crystals-like substance that contains alcohol, and it could be very vital. It could be very deadly, if not harmful to individuals.
The thing that I first thought about, not first, but when I started looking into this, was do we know how much powder would equal how much a shot contains of alcohol? I mean, what is the measurement that would be included with this powdered alcohol?
That's a great question. I'm an attorney, not a chemist, so I'm going to leave that to the chemist. But I think the fact that we're banning this and this is on the market is also dangerous.
Playing devil's advocate, though, shouldn't people have the choice whether or not they want to use this if they do indeed want to use it in a safe way?
Well, we always have that argument, especially when it comes to seatbelts and cars and other, let people do what they want to do. But I think for minors, we have to get this substance out of the hands of minors who can be used for potential date rape and other things. So, I mean, yeah, I guess you can argue that, but I think the state has to get involved when a safety issue is involved.
And couldn't you just as easily pour a little bit of liquid into somebody's drink that is alcoholic and receive achieve the same goal?
You're correct. Unfortunately, you could, but I mean, but this is actually something that you can physically take, and you may be able to stop somebody from pouring a liquid into a drink. Powder, I don't know.
Yeah, one of the things I did hear, and this was when it was being promoted by some people that were for it, is if you didn't want to have that glass of wine with dinner, you'd be able to sprinkle alcohol on your food, and that would be a real possibility with this.
Yes, it could be. It could be very dangerous and lethal.
What other kind of research have you done into this? How far along are we into seeing this actually go on the market?
Well, I don't know if it's been on the market. I know the Alcohol, Wine, and Beverage Association is supporting this legislation, so they're concerned. So I don't know if it's been on the market here in Illinois. I know other states, like I said, or surrounding states have barred this type of powder. So I think it's something that we're going to have to deal with, especially if they're going to do it on a federal level. The feds must think this is a serious element, too.
You talked about Chuck Schumer earlier. Have you contacted anyone on the federal level with your concerns?
No, I mean, I think based upon the way the federal government works, we'll probably work faster in Illinois than over there in Washington.
What kind of priority have you given this as far as, is it in the committee right now? Where is it going?
It's probably, we just introduced it last week, 2 weeks ago, so it'll probably be going to committee the first or second week of February, and then hopefully, I've not heard any opposition, and I think most of my colleagues would probably be in favor of something like this.
Which committee will it be in?
Maybe public health or judiciary. Don't know yet.
Well, the reason why I ask is, is it going to be possible for people that want to speak on this to be able to come and do so?
Sure. If they want to call my office, I'll be more than happy to give out my phone number. It's 217-782-5500. Call my office or email me your comments, pro or against. I'm always open-minded to hear what other people have to say.
And with all of the other bills that may be coming up with this new governor and some of the other budget problems that are going on, do you think it'll actually make it to the floor? Do you worry about that?
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. Of course, you can't predict anything in Springfield anymore.
Have you talked to Mike Madigan?
No, I haven't. I have not talked about Speaker Manning about this, but I take one bill at a time in Springfield.
That was State Senator Ira Silverstein with our Terry James. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Governor Bruce Rauner announced this week he wants to see Illinois establish right-to-work zones, where employees at union shops would be able to opt out of the workers' union. That proposal sparked protests at a Rauner event in Champaign. Illinois AFL-CIO President Michael Kerrigan talked to WJBC's Joe Ragusa this week about what impact right-to-work zones would have on union fees.
What do these fees really mean for the overall union as far as a source of revenue and a source of income, and then what those fees actually are used for?
Well, as part of the collective bargaining agreement, employees become union members. They pay union dues. The union dues, of course, then drive the union operation. It pays for the officers. It pays for the clerical. It pays for people who uphold the union contracts, deal with the day-to-day business. And these fees are just the cost of the operation of the union. And union members come to union meetings at least monthly, and they have an input and a say, and they direct policy and they elect their leadership. But as everybody knows, there's cost associated to an organization, and that's what the union dues do.
And I imagine if these right-to-work zones were established and there were areas where people didn't necessarily need to pay union dues to have a job in a certain trade or anything like that, that it could really impact the bottom line for these unions and their operations.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what Governor Rauner is out. I mean, this is an attack on unions and their efforts to better the quality of life for their members and, in fact, all those in the middle class. The idea is to stop the payment of union dues, and that, in effect, is to diminish, weaken, or eliminate the unions themselves because they're the ones who fight back against the mega-wealthy corporate people like Bruce Rauner.
Michael Kerrigan is the president of the Illinois AFL-CIO, and he's with us here on WJBC. So it seemed like to me that Governor Rauner was trying to at least soften the kind of the impact that his announcement earlier this week had, in saying that he didn't want or wasn't necessarily advocating for a statewide right-to-work law. When you heard that part of his announcement, how did that make you feel in regards to his policies?
Well, what it made me feel is he's thought very seriously about Plan A, which would be a right-to-work law in Illinois, and then he's looked at the makeup of the Illinois House and Senate and said, I can't get it done, so I'll go to Plan B. And I'll try to work on these area or zones. I haven't seen the details, but it's like he calls it employee empowerment zones. Recently, Kentucky, the state of Kentucky, has been involved with this, and the Kentucky Attorney General has got an opinion out which clearly says this plan, this methodology is illegal.
So, and that's, you brought up a key point with that as well earlier, aside from the fact that it might be illegal and the Kentucky Attorney General's point, that the legislature does have to actually rule on this. It's not just the governor that can decide something like this. So do you think that maybe if he just tries to go small with it and say that we can just establish zones instead of a statewide law, that maybe the legislature might be more willing to do something like that?
Well, the position of the Illinois AFL-CIO is we're against the right to work as a state law, and we're against the right to work in these zones or area. He would have to pass legislation in Illinois in order to do the zone right to work plan, or I guess he could try to move forward, but he'd find himself in court. What you're doing here is, if I understand it correctly, he's probably trying to set aside or use, let me say that differently, he's probably trying to use home rule authority to in effect not abide by state law. And state law doesn't allow right to work. It upholds prevailing wage. It upholds project labor agreements, and that these are the things that he talked about in his presentation earlier this week.
That was Michael Kerrigan, president of the Illinois AFL-CIO, with Joe Ragusa. Many of the commercials you'll see during the Super Bowl are supposed to make you laugh, but one ad that a local domestic violence group is promoting is soliciting a far different reaction. The Corporate Alliance to End Partner Violence has been partnering with the National Football League since last fall to help the league address domestic abuse and help raise awareness about its prevention. Director Kim Wells talked to WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week about the group's efforts and the ad which the league is donating $4.5 million to run during the Super Bowl.
Here's the commercial that's going to run. This is the 60-second version of the commercial that's going to run for nomore.org.
Operator 901, where's the emergency?
127, bring me.
Okay, what's going on there?
I'd like to order a pizza for delivery.
Ma'am, you've reached 911. This is an emergency line.
Large with half pepperoni, half mushroom.
You know you've called 911. This is an emergency line.
Do you know how long it'll be?
Okay, ma'am, is everything okay over there? Do you have an emergency or not?
Yes.
And you're unable to talk because...
Right.
Okay, is there someone in the room with you? Just say yes or no.
Yes.
Okay, it looks like I have an officer about a mile from your location. Are there any weapons in your house?
No.
Can you stay on the phone with me?
No. See you soon. Thank you.
All right, at that point, the screen goes to black and the graphic comes up. When it's hard to talk, it's up to us to listen. Help end domestic violence and sexual assault. Pledge to say no more. .org and a link to their website, nomore.org. Kim, what was your reaction when you first saw that commercial?
I think it's incredible. You know, you had mentioned this in the half hour before, Scott, and yes, this is a buy by the NFL. It's a $4.5 million give for this ad that's going to run in the first quarter of the Super Bowl. And actually, I don't know if you guys know this. This is based on an actual real 911 call. So I think it's amazing. I think that it gets to the heart of the issue, and it's a very simple but profound call to action.
So, Kim, whose idea was it to, you know, put together an ad and run it during the Super Bowl?
Honestly, it was a push from folks that are working with the NFL and folks from No More. But honestly, it was the NFL, the folks like Anna Isaacson and the group there that really want to do this. As you guys probably know, if you've been watching games, No More ads have been running the whole season. And really, the hope was, how amazing would it be from the beginning, if we actually had an ad run on the Super Bowl, how awesome would that be? Because that, like you guys, as we were saying, $4.5 million.
Yeah.
is a lot of money to a lot of gifts.
And
I think, you know, people can say this is, you know, one more glossing over, but it's not. It's once again them putting their money and their time and their effort where their mouth is.
Not only their time, you know, the placement of the ad, too. I mean, they very easily could have said, yeah, okay, we're going to put that in the fourth quarter, or we're going to put that post game.
Right.
And they put it in the first quarter when a lot of people are going to see it.
Right, like right at the minute beginning when you're sort of sitting down. And I think that I think that it says a lot by not saying much. And I think that's the beauty of the ad. It's their ad agency, Gray, that created the ad. And I think it's moving. And really what we're asking people to do is very simple. If you go to nomore.org and you go to the homepage, all we're asking people to do is sign a pledge to say no more. And it's amazing to me, you know, when I posted this on my own homepage yesterday, I think there have been like 3,000 views. Now there's like 340,000 views. I can't imagine after the Super Bowl what it's going to be like for people to see this and react and respond to this and not be bystanders to take action.
So, Kim, since they put this panel together, which you're a part of, how's it going with how's it going with the NFL? I mean, we're seeing the ads.
Yep. Well, you know, the personal conduct policy is out. We are super close with the violence response policy, the sort of separate domestic violence response policy, and the critical response team, which is, not to bore you with too many details, but what we suggest that workplaces do is have that sort of, sometimes it's called domestic violence response team, critical response team is what the NFL is choosing to call it, that sort of does the investigation and the response and dealing with the issues. So we are super close. You know, the commissioner had said by Super Bowl, and man, we are almost there.
Talk about Anna Isaacson, who was basically tabbed by Roger Goodell to head up the league's I think it's social responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean exactly? What else is she handling? And what do you think of her leadership?
She's handling a lot. I mean, she's sort of coordinating. I mean, there's a group of extremely dedicated people that are coordinating all of this social responsibility with looking at these issues, looking at how they're reaching out to organizations with the funding like they did with the hotline, with the internal work that they're doing. She just has and it's not only this issue. I mean, there's a lot of social responsibility things that the NFL does with children and, you know, all of the different charities that they do. And Anna has all of that on her plate. She's really an amazing person.
I also understand you mentioned to me off air that you're also getting involved with the NHL. Is that right?
Since I've talked to you guys, we have become involved with the NBA and Major League Baseball. And I was supposed to be actually today at a meeting with the NHL, which obviously for no reasons I'm not. And that was just to sort of have a discussion about where they kind of want to go in looking at the issue of domestic violence and sexual assault. And then, you know, with our local Midwest Professional Basketball Association, we recently formed a partnership. It's amazing to me, you guys, that to see these sports organizations take a look at this issue from a workplace standpoint and also wanting to train the young people that are coming up, you know, through their workplaces to really understand these issues and be better prepared. It's, you know, I couldn't have conceived of this 5 years ago, 3 years ago. So, yeah.
Well, why stop with sports? I mean, every big corporation, I mean, we've gone through it here with one of the many owners. We sit there, we are told we have to watch a videotape on whether it's domestic violence or issues at work, you know, how you treat one another at work, and we have to sign off on it. I could see that coming to every workplace.
Well, you know, that's my goal, you know. Then I'll go do something else, because you're right, Scott. Every single workplace should be addressing domestic violence as a workplace issue. It's really easy to say, oh, that's a sports issue. But, you know, we're founded by State Farm because State Farm realized this was a workplace issue that affected their employees and it affected their insureds. And that's why we work with them and why we work with ISU and why we work with Country and why we work with Heartland and why we have all of those partnerships, because we would love every workplace, large and small, to realize that this isn't just an issue for those places. But what happens is when you have places like the NFL and other sports organizations paying attention, it gives momentum so that other workplaces say, hey, maybe I should take a look at this too. And that's something where we maybe wouldn't have gotten the momentum without that.
That was Kim Wells from the Corporate Alliance to End Partner Violence with Scott and Colleen. The weekend news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the weekend news. The Illinois State University community is mourning the death of a student who was killed in a hit-and-run crash last weekend. 20-year-old Benjamin Allison was reportedly struck by a car at about 9 a.m. on January 24th on College Avenue near Fell. He was a communications major and member of the student radio station at ISU. 21-year-old Joshua Dunn of Normal was charged with drunk driving and leaving the scene of an accident causing death. Dunn reportedly told authorities he was drinking alcohol at a party the night before the accident. Allison is an organ donor through the Gift of Hope program. After Bloomington's City Council decided not to move forward with using a $750,000 grant from State Senator Bill Brady to expand McGraw Park, Brady formed a committee to decide how to allocate the money. Brady announced which projects will receive funding from the grant.
Two important park projects in the city of Bloomington, Sunnyside Park and the Miller Park, water supply needs in the village of McLean, redevelopment of downtown Delavan, and then, of course, the Timber Point at Lake Bloomington.
Brady says the committee looked at which projects would best benefit the area and also considered projects that they believed might not get funding from another source. Bloomington residents had a chance to offer their thoughts on what the city might do to better balance its budget. More from WJBC's Adam Stasinski.
Resident Wes Newport Sr. believes the city council could start by working harder to define the difference between wants and needs.
As far as I'm concerned, wants, the entire Parks and Rec department is wants. Now, I realize you can't just dump it, but I really think that could be reduced.
As an idea for increasing city revenue, another resident, Robert Bosquez, proposed creating an ordinance prohibiting landlords from dumping possessions of former tenants on the side of the street. Bloomington plans to adopt its next fiscal year budget at the end of April. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
A federal mediator needed just one meeting with the District 87 and the Bloomington Teachers Union to end a months-long stalemate.
It certainly was helpful, and you know, I was optimistic going into that meeting, and so was the BEA, and fortunately we were able to, it took a while, but we were able to make progress and reach an agreement.
District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley says the school board will vote on the tentative three-year contract at a meeting on February 11th. The Bloomington Education Association also has to vote on the deal. The bargaining session lasted 8 hours on Thursday. Two sides had met several times going back to April. BEA President Rich Baldwin suggests it didn't need to take this long.
We settled at a point that we were discussing back in mid-November.
The terms won't be disclosed until it's approved by both parties. Congressman Adam Kinzinger was on Fox and Friends on Fox News this week, saying President Obama is fueling terrorists by releasing prisoners from Guantanamo Bay.
You know, folks that are being released from Gitmo, folks that are, they go back as legends. I mean, they survived Gitmo, you know, now, and whether they return to the battlefield or not, they return to some spiritual kind of level.
Republicans say roughly 30% of Guantanamo Bay detainees that are released return to terrorism, but officials within the State Department say that figure is flawed. McLean County has seen a spike in whooping cough cases this year, and health officials are reminding the public to make sure they're vaccinated. The County Health Department's Assistant Director, Kathy Culverston Anderson, says the county has already confirmed 8 whooping cough cases this year. There was only 1 at this time last year.
Whooping cough varies from year to year. It tends to peak every 3 to 5 years. So we may be in a peak year this year, unfortunately.
The health department has sent letters to school principals and nurses to prepare them to look for symptoms. They could appear up to 3 weeks after an infection and might first appear like the common cold, but with an irritating, persistent cough. And now that more parishes feed into Holy Trinity Catholic School in Bloomington, WJBC's Terry James says the name of the school has been changed to Corpus Christi Catholic School.
Monsignor Greg Ketchum says Holy Trinity had been the name for more than 100 years, since the late 1800s.
So there's really 4 parishes feeding into this one school. And in order to better share, have a shared identity, we decided to go with another name identity for the school.
Nearly 100 suggestions were submitted. Corpus Christi means Body of Christ. Terry James, WJBC, and WJBC.com.
Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Central Illinois Regional Airport will formally introduce its new FedEx Express sorting and distribution center there. On Tuesday, Normal will roll out its updated Uptown Renewal Plan, Uptown 2.0, at a public meeting at Uptown Station. Bloomington Ward 1 Alderman Kevin Lauer will hold a meet and greet with constituents on Tuesday night at the Lafayette Club. And Illinois State will host a signing party at the Hancock Stadium Club on Wednesday night as Coach Brock Speck announces this year's recruiting class. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.